Good evening, my name is Fazil, and I am a practitioner doing international development. My question is, in your research as you were writing the book, did you come to find any relations between religion and tradition, and how religion or traditions could contribute to the issue of racism and superiority? I would love to hear more about that.
Thank you. Wonderful question, but also very difficult. We have an intersection of religion and other cultural practices. I find it difficult to categorize these because very often, stereotypically, people align religious practices with specific reasons. And there are people who cross the boundaries, such as middle-class white women coming from the Middle East and converting to Islam, for example, and very often the media, they wouldn't know how to handle those. I really think race shouldn't be the denominator in those cases. There's also the example of upper middle-class white American Buddhists who publicly denounce the practice of a Buddhist of East Asian descent. And it is known that these are two different strands of Buddhism in the US. In those cases, I think the idea that just racialized religious practices, that's really a social imposition. If you ask the practitioners, of course they will reject the notion of thinking that their race has nothing to do with the practice, but it's so culturally ingrained. It's like what I said before, how race is deeply tied into education, but also mannerism, grooming habits, and the basic things that have nothing to do with race per se, right? If you really have to define race as genetics, as skin color. And I think that's my tentative answer along those lines. It's not my particular field, but thank you for raising the question. Other thoughts and comments? Yes, hi.
Hey, my name is Navida. I'm a visiting work fellow at the Sigur Center. I mean, Pete, by you started with the problem of race and epistemologies. And in terms of social theory, how are you looking at it as an epistemological problem, as in it's a given epistemological position that the moment you look at race, you are kind of stuck in a particular epistemological position, and when you're talking about disowning your race, are you then also questioning the whole idea as to how an epistemological position can either be overcome or be questioned or be pluralized? So long and short, where do you really bottom line come down to explain the relationship between race and epistemology, which is the main theory of the book? Thank you.
Thank you. Epistemology, the construction of knowledge. Construction and circulation and endorsement and legitimization of knowledge. And I was interested in how that is related to our understanding of race. My main thesis is that race is something that is profoundly constituted by language, and of course epistemology points to how you know the world, how knowledge is formed. When I gesture toward disowning race, I didn't mean to abandon the epistemological approach that we've taken, but rather to point toward the radical case of racial dualism, but also the allegorical case of the film Gattaca that I analyzed very briefly, and how these might point toward a new obsession of biologically driven understanding of race and how problematic that is. In medical practices, of course, it's very useful because you have statistics of people of specific genetic compositions or specific races that are more prone to certain kind of diseases. But you can see the danger of that, as my colleague David Mitchell would know well, right? I mean, the whole history behind the Holocaust starts out as something innocent that quickly grows into a monster. I just want to draw attention to the relationship between epistemologies and people's understanding or imagination of otherness. Who is the other? And it all comes down to different narratives. So I don't have a specific answer for the world after people claim to disown race, or to say that race is now fluid, the idea of transracial identity, right? Can you become a different race? Can you become whiter and so on? But I just wanted to point out the continued importance of epistemologies in the understanding of race. If you are aware of epistemological foundations, you are aware that race is part of those categories that we come to know the world, then perhaps you'll be more aware of how the so-called definitions are never innocent or neutral, and so on. And it's a useful point to start, rather than saying, here's a new definition of race, and that's how we have to come from now.
Yeah.
Oh,
yes.
Hi. You touched briefly on multiracialism. Do you feel that those who are multiracial should lean more towards the identity to which they appear or people view them as? Or do you think they should cling towards the idea of being multiracial?
How interesting. So a question about multiracialism and multiracial subject, if I understand you correctly, and the question seems to be pointing towards some prescriptive notion of, you know, how they should act. Obviously, I'm not here to say any of that, but I would think in a free society with enough infrastructural support, it will allow diasporic subjects, immigrants, multiracial persons to begin to claim their multiracial, multicultural origins. But in a society where resources are not distributed equally, that would be more of a problem. And this is where the question of simulation comes in. I just read this morning the new media storm, right? The Duke professor sent out an email to tell Chinese study abroad students to stop speaking Chinese on campus because they are harming their career opportunities. And that, of course, has been critiqued as a form of imperialism as well as kind of insensitivity to multiculturalism. That is one example of where people of different origins, they cannot operate as free agent in a society like this. Because the letter in the Duke case clearly threatens quote-unquote consequences, even if it's not named clearly, but consequences will of course be, maybe you don't have, we will not receive a grant, we will not be invited to work in the lab and so on. And that continues. So while all of these things continue, in a lot of societies, what I foresee is obviously people of mixed origins or people who cross many cultural boundaries, they are less free to express all of those. They may end up suppressing some. And we have the entire Asian American literary canon, for example, is about returning home but also becoming someone else. It's about assimilation. If you assimilate well, the society and even your family will be very proud of you because now you are a model minority, you've made it. And there's never emphasis, there's no room yet for emphasis on the different cultural origins because just by the mere fact of speaking another language may make you suspect. Hopefully I addressed some of the questions. Can we think? Yes, hi.
When did the concept or theory of race emerge in our human development? Is it from the very beginning, or is it a 19th century concept, or a 6th? I don't know. I don't know enough about its origins to know how far back we have to unpeel in order to become post-racial or transracial or non-racial or whatever the next phase should be.
There is no, as I outlined in the very beginning of the talk, how men and women can be said to be the first races because they use the word race so broadly. It just means communities or even roots or or families and clans mostly, so it's not even about skin color yet. I would say it began to stabilize toward mid and late 17th century and also 18th century because it's quite fluid, and as a lot of people know, for example, racism or even colonialism, these concepts are anachronistic if you apply it to, say, early modern Europe, because mind you, they have their own racism, they're just different vocabularies, right? Or homoeroticism, for example. Same-sex relationships were not as much of a taboo compared to bestiality, something that they're far more interested in, more concerned with. So there's the historical fluidity of words and concepts. It doesn't mean that they were more progressive, or just because they didn't use the race in a particular way, they were not racist. So that's an excellent question. We did spend some time on that, but didn't put too much emphasis as kind of pinpoint this is the date when race came into the discourse, or this is the date when racism started. Racism, broadly speaking, is simply discrimination by one community against another. And of course, you see that in sexism and post-colonialism and all of that as well. All right, so if there's no more pressing question, I'm going to wrap one more. Yes.
Okay. So I was just wondering what you think about the term colorblind when used by white people to make themselves sound like they don't discriminate races, but saying colorblind, do you feel like that is in a way like erasing the struggles of different races and, you know, favoring equality over equity?
A lot of actors of color in the UK and US context, actors of color, they actually don't like the term. They actually don't want them to be blind to their color because it's part of the point. I mean, and I don't speak for all actors, but some actors I interviewed, they express strong preference. They are not inviting discrimination, but they are inviting recognition. They want them to recognize the struggle of, say, Black British or Asian British or Asian American actors and the opportunity they don't have. And so it's important to address that. So colorblind or post-racial casting or even post-gender casting is a new term as well. All of these are being debated. I think well-intended, but it's also problematic on many levels when they would disguise discrimination by saying, oh, but I'm not paying attention to race, it's only the merits. But they are disregarding the infrastructure, the discrimination coded in the infrastructure. Say actor A and actor B, they will come to audition, and they're equally good, but the actor A, the CV, you don't have any classical performances, you haven't done any Ibsen or Shakespeare and such, therefore not as good. But do you know why actor B hasn't done any Shakespeare? Well, because maybe he or she hasn't had any opportunity to ever cast in a Shakespeare play, right? And so with the idea of color blind, you're doing certain communities a disservice. In practice, very often that's how it unfolds. So I think it's very problematic. But at the same time, of course, it's a noble goal. One day for society to reach there, to actually be colorblind. But before that, you really need infrastructural reform to allow the same level of support and everything. Then you can truly be colorblind, or post-gender as well. This beginning in classical theater, they try to cast people in various roles, disregard of whether the role you're playing is of the same gender as you. They call it post-gender, or even gender-blind. So it's really interesting development. Thank you for the excellent question. It's very rich. And you see that in a lot of, say, Crazy Rich Asians, right? The film family is not here. I would say the quality of the film is not that great, but it's important. Why? Because this is the first time we have a mainstream film with all Asian cast. That's the kind of symbolic significance versus artistic. All of that. Or Black Panther, right? Its meaning to Black American and so on. Okay. Yes,
So thank you for this really ambitious book and this very clear talk. I'm looking at the outline, and I see that It's really an account of how race is created and marked over the centuries from the point of view of the West. But of course, you're from Taiwan, and you're a native inhabitant of Chinese discourse, right? So I'm just wondering how that affected your approach to this, to these questions. If you thought about Chinese constructions of race or Taiwanese constructions of race as you were constructing this huge account of European mm-hmm. and American construction.
Thank you. Yes, yes, I would admit it's mostly Western. Western European Anglo perspective, that's where my training is. I do allude to various examples of different kinds of racism in East Asia, the obsession of whiteness in Japan, Korea, Taiwan, Hong Kong, for example. You go there, the skincare product and cosmetics is sort of whitening. No one wants to be tan. Tan, you mean you labor under the sun, perhaps, so it's a classicist assumption, but also it's an internalized colonialist attitude. They want to emulate whiteness because it's a superior race, and you see this even in Singapore, a post-colonial location. Britishness is a very interesting construction there. So I do have a number of examples of those, and in other words, race from the perspectives of those cultural locations. As for my own upbringing, I would say I might help check some boxes of diversity, but like quite a number of my colleagues in the room and Patty, we are trained white. That's what my training is. And I feel Shakespeare, one of those. And I didn't go to graduate school in Asia. I don't have intellectual roots there. Family roots is completely different. So I acknowledge that in chapter 6 of the book. I talk about the two co-authors, kind of cultural background, journeys, and so on, and how I find myself a bit of insider and outsider, kind of a diasporic subject on both sides of the Pacific and now Atlantic, thanks to my French husband and French family, but also links to Taiwan and just everywhere and a bit of nowhere. But at the same time, the US is my home, and that's where my training is, my whole career, and that idea of kind of in betweenness has prompted me to write a book, kind of very self-aware, in a good way, very self-conscious, very self-aware of my positionality, like where I am, and how do I look at all of these issues, both with the lens of insider, but sometimes also as an outsider. I think it's beneficial, and scholarly, when we take on a project, it's useful to try to maintain, or maybe create artificially, that outsider position, even without personal experience, I suppose. Thank you, Patty, for that.